Well, the Northern Hemisphere excursion of the On The Way podcast continues today with one of the favourite ever guests we've had on the podcast joining me. Last time we chatted, he was in the Garden City Cinemas in Brisbane in the meeting room with Sue Grimmett and myself. Today, it was our turf last time. It's his turf today. I'm sitting in the barn at his place. William Paul Young does join me, author of The Shack, Crossroads, Eve, Lies We Believe About God, and a couple more books on the way shortly. We'll touch on that shortly. But Paul, thank you so much for I was going to say for joining the podcast, but also for picking me up from the airport here in Portland, Oregon. And
thanks for buying lunch. He bought lunch. That doesn't happen very often. So that was very nice. Well, and by the way, I'm trying to get rid of the William at the front, even though my name is William Paul Young.
Yes.
I'm going Paul Young from now on because the William has been so confusing to people. I'm one of four generations of William.
Sure.
None of us go by our middle name.
There we go.
But elsewhere in the world, they didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it was
an American thing, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Now, look, we've had a wonderful day so far. I'm so grateful for your hospitality as I've seen this part of the world for the very first time. And Portland Airport is something to behold a little bit, isn't it? There was a busker when I walked out of the plane, and
yep,
some food trucks set up in the terminal. It's the most creative airport of all time in this corner of the world.
It's in the United States, it ranks usually up in the definitely in the top 10.
Does it?
Of best airports in the country. So
there we go.
But it is, and the Pacific Northwest is one of the most beautiful parts of the world. Kind of. I hate to say this to an Aussie, but it's kind of similar to New Zealand.
Sure,
in many respects.
Yep.
New Zealand is just absolutely an amazing place.
Oh, I'm a massive fan of New Zealand. You don't need to apologize for that at all. But look, I'm so excited for the chance to chat again 6 years on. Last time it was with Sue Grimmett. This time flying solo here we are just in Washington State, aren't we?
Just barely.
Yes.
Because Oregon, where we lived the last 40 years, is just across the Columbia River from us. So I'm actually about 35 minutes from downtown Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, right. And that's where we are having this conversation today, and the beautiful surrounds of the pine trees all around us. And it's a conversation I've been looking forward to for a while, because obviously the Shack has impacted so many people, both the book and then the film adaptation, for almost 20 years now since it was released in 2007. And one of the most powerful things about the phenomenon that Shack has been, that it's done, is echo the personal love of God, of the divine, to each and every one of us in a way that I think sometimes is someone who identifies as maybe a progressive Christian, someone who has been a part of the deconstruction movement of questioning things and really getting into bringing logic to the table. Sometimes that sense of a personal connection to the divine mystery can feel a long way away. And so that's what I wanted to talk about in this conversation. But I'm just curious, before we get into any of that, as we look at the Shack, you know, coming up on, I guess this time 20 years ago, you were in the earliest drafts of it. Is that about right?
Yeah, 2007 was when it got actually put in print. But
yep,
I wrote it in 2005.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've just been, this shows the gift that I've had today. Paul has just read the first chapter to me of the sequel to The Shack, which is a very rare gift. That's still a few years off, you think, that one.
Right, and he has to forget it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't make me sign an NDA or anything like that.
Shoot. I know I should have done that.
But that's gonna be amazing when that does come out. But I'll share maybe a little bit about my experience of The Shack, because as somebody who did grow up in a very fundamentalist Christian environment, as much as the theology was problematic and there were a lot of scars that were probably formed from what I was raised in some respects, there was also in the youth group environment that I had this deep sense of being seen, being known, and I think being loved. There was a real relationship that I felt, at least. There was a felt experience of that relationship that, as much as today, my understanding of things, my sense of things, what we explore on the podcast is much more, I think, inclusive of everybody, something that matches much more up with science and what we know about the natural world, and is a number of steps forward on actually meeting or being up to meeting the mystery of reality than what I had growing up. But yet that key ingredient of feeling, experiencing the feeling of being seen, known, and personally loved is often missing. And I remember when I first read The Shack and then saw the film as well, being moved to tears a number of times by, particularly in the film, Octavia Spencer, who plays Papa God as this African-American woman, as God the Father, or God the Mother, as it is in the film, just being moved by this sense of being personally loved. And I'm curious, as we start off on that point, Paul, do you find that on the deconstruction end, the liberal end of whatever is emerging out of the Christian movement, that this personal connection is something that people often struggle to maybe feel? Maybe when you're so concerned by what the word God actually means, what we mean when we use that word, you kind of struggle to feel loved by it because it's such an abstract concept.
Sure. When you say it, it's an abstract concept.
Sure. Yeah.
So you have to realize that the deconstruction, quote unquote, deconstruction movement is a small community of people who are struggling with the very same things that you've mentioned, you know, coming out of a strict or legalistic, legal forensic kind of religious Christianity, and that has impacted a lot of us. And I include myself in there. My deconstruction had way more to do with my own personal movement towards wholeness. Then, yes, there was a lot of elements of my brokenness that included the way that I saw God. And that had to be dealt with. But the longing for the divine, the longing for the higher power, the longing for something bigger than myself, that has always been there. Mm. And, you know, I had a very rough childhood in the midst of some of the issues with growing up in a world where sexual abuse was a part of it, and not in my immediate family, but in the tribal culture and then in boarding school and things like that. And at the same time, it was that sense of the transcendent that kept me in some ways safe. And that longing grew, even as I isolated myself to protect myself, or trying to adapt to the culture that was in front of me. In boarding school, it was a culture I didn't even understand. But when I went out into the woods and found these, they had a particular seed that had wings on it, and you could, you know, I was 6 and 7 years old, you could let it go and the wind would catch it, and it would float down sometimes in a waving fashion, 100, 200 meters. And just would fly. And little things like that, to see the bird of paradise, to see some of the animals or the myriad kinds of snakes, whatever it was. And I was much safer in the world that wasn't inhabited by human beings. Although I desperately wanted to belong somewhere. And home had not been safe. My dad made sure of that. But there's this longing for a place where you fit and belong with no question. And I think that resides in the heart of all human beings. People who say that the logic and rationality expunges the sense of the transcendent, I don't think they have children. That would be my guess. You know, I have a good friend, and he's an atheist, a stated atheist, and he loves the shack, which is so interesting to me. And I said, okay, Matt, tell me about what you do believe. What do you believe in? And he's like, you want me to tell you what I believe in? And he says, nobody ever asked me that. They asked me what I don't believe in. Mm. And I said, yeah, I want to know what you believe in. And he thinks for a minute and he goes, I'll tell you what I believe in. As irrational as it sounds, I believe in the love that I have for my sons. He said, I would die for them. I would step in front of a bullet for them. I would lay down my life for them. And so I asked him, I said, so how about this definition? Other-centered, self-giving, co-suffering, self-sacrificial love. He goes, that's exactly what it is. What he didn't know at the time was that is the definition of love that's in the New Testament. God is love. It uses agape. And the definition of agape is other-centered, self-giving, self-sacrificial, co-suffering. And so it's like there is this thing in us. Mm. You know, if we have any health at all and we have children or grandchildren, or you're inside of a family situation of one sort or another, and you are around children. You know, even in this time where children are being slaughtered, right, in certain parts of the world, that reaches into the deepest parts of us like nothing else will, which is kind of sad and shouldn't be that way. Like everybody that's out there was once a child, and so that child still remains in them. But for us, it's, you know, we have our 16th living grandchild on the way. And you know, when I'm around my grandkids, there's no possibility that I could think this life was not transcendent in one form or another.
Yeah.
So that deconstruction, I suppose it's a good word to capture the idea that we need to break down those things in our past and in our history, in our whatever it is, that prevent us from being fully human and fully alive. But the thing that we have to watch carefully is that that deconstruction will take away from us some of the things that are true and right and good. And you mentioned that right off the bat by talking about growing up in a particular conservative, legalistic religious framework, but experiencing belonging in some ways that transcended all the logic of the theology.
I remember Friday night youth groups. Occasionally we would hang around for what they call these extended worship sessions. They'd begin at 9 p.m. Sometimes they'd go to midnight. They would just sort of go on and on. And I can't remember any of the particular religiosity of it. I can't remember what I was asked to do or believe or confess or any of those sorts of things. But I do remember being in a room with about 15 or 20 others late into the evening. And there was an intimacy to the space. There was a sense of being held in the space. And it was such a profoundly enriching sense of belonging, I think. So I'm curious, when you speak about the sense of feeling personally loved by the divine or personally loved by God, what does that experience look like or feel like in your own lived experience?
Oh, that's a great question. Part of it is, as you said earlier, is that you're actually seen and that you're actually known and that there is a deep and resonant sense of connection, like indwelling, which we would call union, that there is a union between the divine and myself resident within me, right? So there's not a sense of separation from that. And that God would know everything about me, and not only cares for me, but is actively present to work my wholeness into being, right? So that there is shared joy because of union. There is shared experience because of union. There is shared, you know, that God dwells within my totality, emotional, logical, creative, in this body. And that God can speak to me through all of those things, whether it's my rationality or my relationships or my work or my creativity or my play or my emotions, imagination, that all of those are dwelt within. And out of that communion comes a non-separated experience of life.
That's a beautiful way to put it, a non-separated experience of life.
I've never put it that way, but I think it's pretty beautiful too.
Well, and I think it's I think what's always stuck out to me about the shack, that the line I probably think of most often when I come back to it, is that line of God the Mother, as it is in the shack, of "I'm especially fond of you," which is such a, I think last time we spoke, Paul, we spoke about the idea that moves it from God being loving to you being lovable.
Who's the subject? Who's the object?
Yes.
Yeah. If I say I love you,
yeah,
I am the subject, you're the object. But if I say, Dom, I'm especially fond of you, and now suddenly Dom becomes the subject of that, and I get to talk about it. It's you as opposed to anyone else that I'm talking about. I'm not just making a generic statement of I love you.
Yes, which would be about how loving Paul is.
Correct. And I think that's what really impacted people. It was a little line that kept resonating with me as I wrote it, like, oh, okay, this goes deeper in some respects. It recognizes the person specifically.
Yes, you know, yes.
There is a you that I am especially fond of. It's not a generic kind of love, but there is something special and a special kind of fondness. Yeah.
I think it was maybe May or June of 2018 that you joined us for the podcast in Brisbane. And a few months after that, I welcomed my first niece into the world. My older brother had his little girl, Maddie, and I flew down to Adelaide to meet Maddie for the first time. First time I'd had a niece or a nephew. And it was one of the sort of transcendent milestones, I think, of my life, where I remember holding this baby in my arms and looking in her eyes and thinking, there is no narrative of not enough that has entered this story yet. All of that comes later, tragically. That will come as she grows. But right now, as this baby's in my arms, there is nobody would look at this and see any incompleteness, any flaw, any problem. No one's saying, oh, she probably should have been doing more by her second day. What's going on here? There's just this sense of enough, radical enoughness and completeness and perfection. And so there's this weird sense in which that especially fond of you is true on day one. And it's almost like we learn the other narrative as we grow older. We don't get invited to a birthday party in year two or someone pushes us off the swing in primary school. And these things teach us a whole new narrative, which is in a sense riding over the first story.
Yeah. And part of it is what is involved with knowing. The beautiful thing that about transcendent and divine love is that we are completely known, right? And therefore completely loved. And the baby held in your arms is unique. And so there is a basic knowing, and the love is encompassing that which is there, that we know, which is remarkable. We loved that baby while the baby was in the womb.
Yes, yes. Okay?
And now as that baby grows, becomes a child, we begin to see the more that is there to love. Because love, I was talking to you earlier, love is the skin of knowing. It's not actual love that grows, it's knowing that grows.
And people in long-term marriages probably can
pick
up on that, you know. And there's a sense, you said to me earlier when we were having lunch, the difference between love and infatuation is a difference of knowing.
Correct. Because there's nothing that'll mess with your infatuation than getting to know the person, you know? So infatuation is based on not knowing.
Yeah.
And and not knowing, if you have an infatuation, all you're doing is projecting that which you need onto the face of that person. It's no different than porn in a magazine. It's just porn in the flesh. Mm. And because it's all about you. And that's why as you get to know, you realize that person is not going to meet my need, right? Yeah. And so it's the knowing, the actual knowing that destroys that which is not real. And, you know, Kim and I have been married for 44 years now. And we're the best we've ever been. And we went through hell. I brought most of the hell, almost all of the hell. But as our knowing of each other has grown, there is an assumption. We assume that love rather than try to win that love or to earn that love. We simply assume that love. And it's not something we even try to do. It is the assumption that underlies our relationship, and it's based on the knowing. The knowing has continued to grow and continued to grow. And that will never end. We will never get to the place where we know everything. That will never happen.
I'm thinking as you share that, it reminded me of something I heard Richard Rohr say a few years ago about how we often need to have the unconditional acceptance and love mirrored to us in human form, but by somebody else before we can really believe that it's possible about the deepest truths of reality and about God. That there's a sense in which a parent, a friend, a partner, it's often when we have seen that deep knowing love in human form from somebody in our lives and experience that, that's when we're able to believe this might be true of everything.
Yeah. And we all basically have imposter syndrome. Like they're going to find us out. you know?
Yeah.
And, yes. And so, you know, that's the essential necessity of communion, communion, community, relationships, because we will not tell ourselves the truth that has a way to penetrate through our own damage. You will not come to freedom or wholeness in isolation. It won't happen. You'll just begin to serve that which you believe to be true. And so we need the mirror not only to tell us what is actually true, but to also tell us what we think is actually true that is not. You know, so, you know, that's why in some respects Jesus says to love your enemies, because they can push your buttons like your friends never will.
Yeah, sure, and, sure.
And the unexposed is the unhealed. So the stuff that is down there that is damaged needs to be brought to the surface so that it can be cleaned. And there's a verse that says, the Holy Spirit has come to convict the world. And the word convict in the Greek is to expose, to come to expose the world. So when you go through a COVID or something like that, all kinds of crap came up in people's lives and relationships. Well, that becomes the opportunity for healing. And relationships will do that. Richard Rohr also, we were driving along in a car one day and he says, this might be strange coming from a celibate Franciscan priest. But he said, I think one of the greatest gifts that God ever gave the human race was marriage, because there's nothing quite like it that won't bring your crap to the surface.
Mm.
Or as I told you, a friend of mine said, we thought we were whole and healthy human beings, and then we got married.
Yeah.
And there is something about that. I'm going to read you a poem by an Aussie friend of mine named David Tenson. I don't know if you know David or not.
I don't.
Oh, fantastic poet. Married with kids, therapist, poet.
Yeah, beautiful.
And this is about deconstruction.
Okay.
If you must deconstruct, take every part, weigh, measure, keep, and discard necessary things. Take all the time you need, but do not camp in the ruins. Discuss discoveries, but do not raise monuments to your brilliance. Brave as you may be, instead, in time, build something new. Take the remains, sorrows, and pains, new friends you've gained, and build something new, allowing the wise few to remind you there is a time to break down and a time to build up.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think that so beautifully captures this sense that a lot of people caught up in the deconstruction movement have had, which is that the room was just left barren.
Yeah.
We just stripped it all out, put it all out in a bin out the front.
Yeah.
And then sort of sat in this room where at least none of the bad stuff was there anymore, but sooner or later you start to hear that knocking on your heart thinking, but there is something going on here, isn't there?
Yeah.
And it's really interesting, Paul. I was thinking recently about the amount of people I hear who aren't religious at all, haven't had any part of a religious background, who now will say things like, let's see what the universe brings for me.
Of course.
You know, I think that's the one at the moment is, we'll see what the universe wants.
Well, it's this funny thing about human beings that we will personify a force.
Yeah.
Right? I don't believe in God, but I believe in a force. And it's like gravity, you know? And no, not like gravity, because that's an impersonal force.
Yeah.
But they can't help themselves. There is something transcendent. You end up with an empty room, beauty will come calling.
Yes.
Or a relationship will come calling.
Yes.
Or love, or seeing a child hurt will come calling. In a room that's empty, you will still find a place in your own heart for something that indicates that something is good and something is wrong.
Mm.
You know, and good luck not being able to eat of the tree of life when it's there, because it's like life matters.
So people who might say, I hear that and I can deeply feel loved unconditionally by my mom or my dad or my spouse or my friends or my children, but this next step of feeling deeply personal loved by a God who I don't know what I believe to what that God to be, what I mean by that word, if that God exists, you can get so caught up in knots so easily. But what is, how do you return? And return might not be the best language, I'm not sure, but how do you find your way to that sense of being loved by a mystery beyond our comprehension?
You know, I would say for the first response is that the love you've experienced from your mom or your dad or someone who's come into your life is not different from the love that you receive from God. If the love is kind and pure and good and other-centered, you being the center of that love, and self-sacrificial, that is, that they've laid down their life, right? That it is co-suffering. When you cry, they cry, right? This is exactly the same. So don't make such a big jump decision to go from one to the next. You know, recognize in the ways that you have been loved that that person is also indwelt in expressing the love that they don't have apart from that presence of God in them.
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yep. And sure. So it's like, no. And then begin to even to look at nature or creation. And many people that don't want to tag themselves with a religious viewpoint or term, and I get that. I 100% get that. I have a problem with that. That they can see in creation, in nature, an expression of the goodness and the beauty of a God who cares for us. Look at how this thing has just been so finely tuned, and yet it has its own capacity to express itself, you know, like the seeds or the weeds, you know. And so the next step is what? Is to express that love to someone you care about and let that grow. You know, there's not a finish line here. like my people told me that if you don't get to that finish line, you're going to get to hell. You know, that's the prize for the person who didn't get there, you know. Yeah. And which I think is rampant rubbish. And so, you know, the idea of eternal conscious torment, hell, you know, that God has a special place for most human beings in which he is going to torture them. Like, what kind of nonsense is that?
Yes.
And I mean, that will bother my people for every time I say something like that, because, you know, they're depending on the fear of hell to prove that they are better than somebody else. But it's like, no, look at, I've got all these friends that are on death row. And I'm a lot of places that will be listening to this. They don't have a death row, and thank God you don't have a death row. But in the America, we still have it. And they're my friends. I don't go see them because I quote unquote, I have a ministry. No, I don't have any ministries. I kind of don't like that word. It's kind of a word of superiority and separation. And I have friends, I mean, real legitimate friends. And when I'm with them, we talk about some of these very things. And I'm like, okay, who amongst us, including all my friends on death row, at the core of their being wants to be someone who lies? Who at the core of their being wants to be someone who kills? At the core of their being is someone who wants to be unkind? None of them, unless they have an extreme mental illness of some sort or another, are psychopathic, or they all, without exception, at the longings at the deepest parts of their heart, want to be someone who is kind and good and a truth teller. And so move in the directions of the deepest longings of your heart. Work on becoming a truth teller. Begin to augment and amplify your kindness. You know, God is always about invitation to participate.
Yes.
You know, and I love that. So how do I experience God more? I don't know. How about be responsive to the person or situation that is right in front of you? How about instead of not dealing with your addiction, finding a 12-step program? Mm. How about caring for someone, listening to that voice on the inside that draws your attention to someone who has need and responding to it? How about finding a therapist and start dealing with your crap? and not for any other reason that than you want to become whole. You know, there's a lot of things that you do because, frankly, the limitations of the broken places of your heart limit your capacity to experience any love, let alone the love of God.
This actually, what you just said there reminds me of something of yours that you said last time we had you on that I've quoted for years since then, your interpretation of the wrath of God, which to me, I still think just redeems the end. Every time the wrath of God is mentioned now in ancient scriptures, it's redeemed because of what you said. Could you talk a little bit about
that? I have no idea what I said, but I'll tell you what how I would talk about it now.
Sure.
And it may be exactly the same thing. There are all of these words in the Greek for judgment or wrath. I like wrath.
Yes.
And they say wrath here, just so you know. So all of these words for judgment, like kolesis or krisis. There's one, temereo, that is just flat out retributive vengeance, punitive retributive vengeance. That word is never used for God, ever. All the other words are words for reconstruction, reformation, healing. They always have the end in mind of being whole. So what is the wrath of God? It is the fiery fury of the love of God that is opposed to anything in you that is not of love's kind and therefore intends to absolutely destroy anything in you that is keeps you from being fully human and fully alive. So the wrath of God is not against you. It is against that which is harming you. So let me give you a bigger framework. In the Western Christian evangelical world, there was the movement towards what's called forensic theology, which is legal theology. It is a courtroom picture of justice. And in legal theology, you have your judge that sits on the throne. This, in this case, it would be God the Father. And then you have your barrister, your defense lawyer, who would be Jesus. And if you've paid him, he will defend you. And so how do you pay him? You pay him by praying the sinner's prayer, inviting Jesus into your heart, telling him that he'll be now Lord of your life, whatever. Yes. That's the payment. So, but the thing about it is that the judge is your defense attorney's dad. And so, you know, you have direct access if you pay him. Now, the judge may actually like you, but his hands are tied by the law. The law that says, if you sin, you got to die. And you got to be, then you're sentenced. And you're sentenced to what? If you're guilty, you're sentenced, my people would say, eternal conscious torment, heart, hell, right? Hell. And they don't realize that there's a number of problems with this whole picture. One is that God is under the jurisdiction of the law that says you've got to be sentenced, which means that the law is actually God, because anything that God is submitted to and under bondage to is God, right? So the law would be God. But the other thing is that most people don't pay the, you know, the defense attorney. So they're going to go straight to hell. God may love you and all that, but you're still going to go to hell.
Yes.
And another problem is that Jesus, what he can do when, if you paid him, he will go to his dad and he will say, I'm going to take the punishment myself, right? That's the picture that forensic theology has. And the problem is he never did. So he's going to say that I'll take the eternal conscious torment, but he never did. Jesus doesn't have eternal conscious torment. And so it's kind of a big, you know, yes. Switcheroo anyway.
Plot hole.
Yeah. Yeah. But the early church did not have that picture at all. The picture of the early church was not a lawyer. And we got that from Calvin, who was a lawyer, Luther, who was a lawyer, Augustine, who was a lawyer. But the early church said, no, they saw the same things in the scriptures and the New Testament. And that is, God is a doctor in a hospital. That's their view. Hmm. Not in a courtroom, a judge in a courtroom, but a doctor in a hospital. So, you know that snake around cross,
Yes, the medical symbol.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And what is their theme? What is their motto? I will do no harm. That's what it says. And it's a snake that's curled around the staff. And, but that's the picture. So do you want to go see the doctor who is going to judge you? Well, yeah, I want to know why I'm sick. Yeah, you know, sure, I want to know why my arm isn't working.
Yes.
I want to know why I have these chronic headaches. I want to know. So I want somebody who thankfully will judge me.
Yes.
Right? So you go to the doctor and the doctor judges you. He says, you have cancer or you have a broken bone or you have migraines. And then the doctor will not only judge you, but sentence you. I sentence you to chemotherapy or I sentence you to a cast on your arm.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about that? Well, finally, somebody's going to help me get whole.
Yes.
And is not going to do any harm.
Yeah.
Right? So that is the picture that the early church had of God being a judge and God sentencing you so that you would finally come to wholeness. Mm. That you would move in the direction of becoming a whole person. And so, yeah, we come to God with all of our brokenness. And from God's side, God is a furious fire. Why? Because God actually loves you and hates everything that is keeping you from being fully human and fully alive. Mm. And suddenly you can go to this God with your arms wide open and say, I am so broken. I am a mess. I am addicted. I am whatever is on your list of things that you think you are. And God will say, I'm going to burn that out of you. It may take a while, but together with your participation, we're going to destroy that which is harming you.
Yeah.
And because I don't do any harm, we're going to move through whatever it takes to bring you to wholeness. But I've loved you from the beginning. And you may say, I'm an addict, and I'm going to say, you're my child. That's who you really are. You can say, I am full of lies, and I'm going to say, the truth about who you are is that you're made in my image and therefore you are a truth teller. That's the truth of who you are. And you can say, I am not good. And God will say, no, you are good. Your orientation has been all wrong. The way that you look at the world has damaged you. The way the world has hurt you, has harmed you, has broken you. We're going to heal that. As it is exposed, we're going to move you in the direction of the person who you really are, a child of God made in the image and likeness of God.
That's beautiful, Paul. I love that. And it makes me think we do have a sliver of this already in the people we love.
Absolutely.
And this is, I think this is another Richard Rohr idea. I heard him say once that if we took the people who hurt us the most in our lives and were given a button that we could push that would send them to be tormented forever in hell, almost every human wouldn't actually be able to bring themselves to push the button.
No.
And yet we believe in a God who we think does.
This is the cave scene, right? This is the cave scene.
Yes, this is the cave scene in the
Absolutely yes. The cave scene.
Yes.
And where Mackenzie, and this is with people whom he loved, and they did it so well in the movie.
Yes.
They had Mackenzie's dad as a child.
Yeah.
And he didn't know it. And so he begins to defend his own father who was massively abusive to him.
Yeah.
Because behind that abusive man was a broken child. But and similarly in the book, it was like, here, pick one of your kids, you know, or a couple of your kids to go to eternal conscious torment. And it's like, no, I can't do it. Send me instead, right? Send me.
Yes.
And that's self-sacrificial, co-suffering, other-centered love.
Yeah. I think, again, and this is becoming my most repeated phrase on the podcast lately, but it's again that moment you realize why people called this good news
for, exactly.
for so many years.
Good news is not, well, now we've told you, you have an opportunity to accept Jesus as your Savior, and if you don't, you're going to go to hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, to the place of eternal conscious torment where God keeps people alive just to torture them.
You're talking about future tripping with me.
Oh, lunch. I know. Future tripping is a word that I coined. Probably somebody else had it too. But it's a word that I coined about how fear pushes you out of the present and the reality of the present into some imagination that doesn't exist. you know, because future tripping, you know, I've been to my own funeral a bunch of times, kind of really pissed me off because nobody else cried or came. And and you know, I've lost all my money at least 100 times and ended up under Burnside Bridge in a cardboard box. You know,
yeah.
It's all future tripping. I'm going to say this, that person's going to say this, and then I'm going to say this. Why even talk to them, you know, because it's, you know, it's all going to end badly. Or I get a call, my boss wants me to come see him at the office, and I'm sure that now not only am I out of a job, but my marriage is going to fail. How am I going to tell my wife? And then, you know, that's its own bunch of future tripping. Mm. And then I'm going to be back under the Burnside Bridge in a cardboard box, you know, and alone. So fear not only drives you into an imagination that doesn't exist, it also drives you into a place inside that imagination in which you are alone and there is no God.
Yeah.
Right. So what is opposite of that? Because as soon as you future trip, now you've got to find a way to control everything that you're afraid will happen, right? All the variables. Mm. And I tell you, if you want something to absolutely wring energy out of your life, future trip and create everything you need to do to make it, to make all the variables solved. I tell you, people who are control freaks, we future trip, when we're starting to deal with this, we'll find ourselves like 250 plus times the first few days. If you want to track it, almost every conversation will involve future tripping.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, oh, how do I stop? Well, you stop, you know, one future trip at a time. Recognize it, laugh at yourself, go back to being present, responding to the person in front of you.
And that's such a, we get ourselves tied in these knots again and again and again.
Horribly.
And the future tripping gets its voice in there. I know Brené Brown uses the phrase dress rehearsing tragedy. She spoke about an old man who said every time his wife was 15 minutes late home from work or from the supermarket, he'd convince himself that she died in an awful car accident. For 50 years, he convinced himself of this, thinking somewhere subconsciously that it would make it easier if that did happen because he'd have emotionally prepared himself. And then she gets a bad medical diagnosis and does pass away. And apparently he says to Brené, didn't make it any easier.
No.
I spent 50 years dress rehearsing the tragedy, thinking that then when it emerged, I'd be able to handle it.
But the grieving then was real. The other grieving was for things that didn't even exist.
It was needless. It never needed to be there.
I found some situation recently where, because I was future tripping, I was grieving the imagination greater than when I was then grieving the actual losses that were involved.
Yeah, right.
We need to grieve well. We need to grieve well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we don't heal well.
Yes.
But it needs to be out things that are real, not things that don't exist. The older I get, thankfully, because this doesn't always happen, but the older I get and the more I've dealt with my crap, the more I'm aware of the wonder of the person with whom I am, the wonder of the person who is in front of me. And when you learn to live in the present tense, not in some future tripping imagination, you learn to be present to the wonder with whom you are present. And that becomes the whole world in the moment. You know, you can't solve all those things that are out there. You can't solve the things that are in your family. You can't solve, but you can respond to what is actually happening. And you know, a lot of people are such fear-based future trippers that they don't even know that that's a possibility. But it is. I was telling Dom, it feels very irresponsible because responsibility and expectations all go together, right? In my relationship with my dad, who died almost a year and a half ago now, I had a really hard relationship with my dad. But I discovered when he turned 80, on a walk with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, I was so angry because my dad had blown some stuff up again. And in that conversation, it became clear to me that, number one, I was the one creating the expectations that my dad didn't have the capacity to live up to. And so when he blew something up is because I set the minefield up. Mm. And that was one thing. The second thing is that I needed to let my dad become something greater than he had been. He had been a dad but I let him become a human being. And now his story mattered. When he was my dad, all that mattered was whether he lived up to my expectations or not, and inevitably he did not. And a way I can describe that is I have two photo albums in my inside house. One that I look at, I used to look at all the time, and one that I didn't look at all. And the one that I looked at all the time was all the pictures in my memory of the ways my dad hurt me. And so that when something happened, present tense, I could go, you know, and he blew something up and he hurt me, I could go back to that photo album in my inside house and I could say, look, he is the son of a bitch he's always been. Look, right? The other album in a dusty old cabinet in my inside house in the shack was the pictures of the things that he did right or he did well or a small kindness or the time when he heard me speak and he leaned over on the way out and he said, Paul, that was the greatest sermon I've ever heard in my life. I didn't want that album because it was against the album that I used to justify my ongoing fury at my dad. And I was talking to my friends on death row and I said, and they said to me, they said, it's a difficult thing to be known only for the worst day of your life. And I thought about this photo album, and that's what I'd done. I had put my dad into a cell framed by the edges of that picture so that I could always go back and say, look, that's who you are. And the American prison system does that exactly. They always treat you for the worst day of your life, and it could be 30 years ago. But you're not allowed to change. That photo album doesn't allow you to move, grow, change, reform, nothing. You're stuck there so that everybody can go back and look there. And I had to let my dad out of that photo album. And to do that, I had to let him become a human being. And it changed our relationship right off the bat. Not because of any expectation. I had to let go of all expectations. And when I did that, everything that happened from that point forward became a gift. Everything. A conversation in which we got to talk longer than 2 minutes because we didn't know how to became a gift. It didn't matter how deep we went. It mattered that we were in a conversation. And then one day he says to me, you need to listen to what I have to say. Paul, I need to tell you something, which in the three phone calls that I had gotten in my life, they all began with, Paul, there's something I need to tell you. And they'd all been tragedies. One of our families had been killed, one of our family members, like my five-year-old niece was killed the day after her fifth birthday. My brother, who was 18, was killed. And they began with that. And he said, this was about 2 months before he died. Paul, I need to tell you something. I said, what, Dad? He goes, no. You need to really listen to me. I said, all right. And I'm thinking, like, who died? And he says, Paul, I need you to hear me. I am really, really, really proud of you. I'm proud of the man you are. I'm proud of the husband you are. I'm proud of the father you are. I'm proud of the way you've touched the world. And I really, really, really love you. And if I'd have kept that album, you know, and all those expectations, my response could easily have been, well, it's about time. But because I'd let go of all that, suddenly this became an unbelievable, beautiful gift that I had not expected, not demanded, not planned for, not future tripped in my imagination. It was just a gift. And then he died not long afterwards, but I had a sense of some deep resolution because his story mattered and who he was mattered. And I could now listen to him without waiting for him to burn something up or give me what I thought I needed. That no longer mattered. He was a human being. That mattered. Being a dad is just a subset of being human. To be human was to be greater than being a dad who didn't have the capacity to be one.
Wow. Yes, totally. And it all comes back to leaning into a relationship in which primarily in this world you are loved. And when you start there as a safe place and a safe universe held in love, regardless of what emerges or doesn't, and stop trying to run the show yourself and push the buttons the way you want them pushed, everything transforms in a pretty radical way.
Do the next right thing. Get help.
Yeah.
If you need help, get help. You know, my life changed the first time when I was 38 years old. I said to another human being, can you help me?
Yeah.
And I hadn't been willing to do it up till then, not until my damage created a huge catastrophe and I blew up the world, my world. Mm. And that's when Kim caught me in a 3-month affair with one of her best friends. And I either had to see, is there a way to change or just do I kill myself? And that started an 11 year process of unwinding and starting to grow and coming in the direction of wholeness. 11 years. And it started right at the beginning with a bunch of therapy, somebody who I could pay to trust. Yeah. That's where it started for me. And 11 years later, it took Kim and I 11 years to heal. Mm. And as I said, we're the best we've ever been. And but 11 years before I finally felt healthy. And Kim is the one who kept saying, you know, someday as a gift for our kids, would you just please write something that puts down in one place how you think, because you think outside the box. And later she told me she was thinking maybe 4 or 5 pages. And the year I turned 50, which was the 12th year, I realized I'm finally healthy enough to do this thing that Kim has been asking me.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm like one of the healthiest people I know. I don't have any addictions. I don't have any secrets. I know finally what it's like to just be a child. I have joy as a constant companion. And I'm the same person in every situation. That is, I'm no different in a hotel room by myself or with a group of strangers or with my friends. I'm no different. I don't play to the audience. Mm. I live from the inside out. In the 12th year, the year I turned 50, I wrote a story for my kids. And who knew?
Well, look, it's such a gift to share a conversation with you always. And to do it here in your home has been a day I don't think I'll ever quite forget, really. So thank you so much for having me here and for sharing so much of yourself in this conversation.
An honor to be with you, Dom. So good to see you.
And and you got plenty coming up in the next little while that people can be across.
Well, you know, if my identity is not built in my production or performance, so we'll just take it a day at a time.
That's true.
And but you know, I've got a lot of things that potentially could happen. Yes. If I die, it'll screw it all up. So,
well, let's not future trip that though.
Yeah, no. Yeah. There's no need for future tripping. When we do planning, like I know I'm supposed to be in Atlanta next in about 3 weeks. So when you do planning, you just hold it loosely. Yeah. You just hold it loosely. I had a full calendar the year that some little, you know, virus showed up and ripped it to shreds. You know, it took my calendar. And it's, and that, you hold it loosely. Mm. You live in the moment responding to that which is actually in front of you.
Yes.
That's where the real life is. That's where love is. That's where joy is, kindness is. That's where compassion expresses itself. Not in some imagination that doesn't exist. Mm. It's only here. This is the eternal moment, is right here, right now. Mm. And that's where life is experienced. You know, otherwise you're just treating imagination and fear as the bandits they are, because they will suck you dry out of anything that's actually real.
Yeah.
You know, so the fight and the work is to stay present. Completely. That's what it is.
And there may at some stage be a book from Paul Young on that topic.
Maybe. We'll see.
We'll see what happens.
It's in the calendar of things to do, but But yeah,
one day.
I think it might be helpful if I'm alive and God wills.
Well, Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dom.